The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Conventional wisdom is the dominant consciousness of any culture. It's a culture's most taken for granted understandings about the way things are, worldviews, image of reality, and about the way to live, its ethos or way of life. It's what everybody knows, the world that everybody is socialized into through the process of growing up. It's a culture's social construction of reality and the internalization of that construction within the psyche of the individual. It is thus enculturated consciousness, that is, consciousness shaped and structured by culture or tradition. So I want to speak today a little bit about the relative truth. Here is being referred to as conventional wisdom. And I'm drawing from this book that I've used before by Marcus Borg. He's a Christian theologian and was part of a group of theologian scholars called the Jesus Seminar, where they kind of sifted through all of the sayings and doings of Jesus to try and ascertain what almost certainly did happen, or did he say what might have happened, and he might have said, and what almost certainly did he not say or do. And when I looked it up online in Wikipedia, it said, described the Jesus Seminar as an heretical group who... So I think we know who didn't write that passage. But he's talking about Jesus and his life and his teachings and the ways in which he was responding to the relative truth, the conventional wisdom of his time. And so it's a good kind of parallel, analog, because it's not Buddhist, but it's talking about the human realm, how we live within cultures, how we take that in, learn from that, that's what growing up is, and how that plays out. He said about Jesus, he said, as a teacher of wisdom, Jesus wasn't primarily a teacher of information, that is what to believe, or morals, how to behave, but a teacher of a way or path of transformation. Of course, in Buddhism, there's a very important, really essential teaching of the two truths. And one of the reasons it's so important is because based in the realization, the practice and realization of emptiness and selflessness, that that can very easily be misunderstood as a kind of nihilism, a sort of negation of everything. Everything's empty, therefore nothing exists, nothing matters, and so on. And so Buddhism has basically been responding to that challenge or that criticism or that misunderstanding since the time of the Buddha. And so presenting the true truths, the relative truth, which is, in Buddhism, the relative truth is everything that we can perceive with our senses, everything we can think and feel. It's what we know. It's sort of what everybody believes to be true. But it's generally presented in terms of the individual, right? Our own perceptions, the way we perceive the world, phenomena, and as have been coming out in the talks this week, how we impute into our perceptions a sense of absoluteness, of absolute separateness, sovereignty, value, characteristic, permanence. The self is seen as something that is continuous, like a soul, so that there is some essence that exists within us that is the essence of you and I, which kind of holds the essence of who you are, your uniqueness, your individuality, your personality, and so on. And what the Buddha was enlightened to is that upon deep examination, that no such self or entity or permanence or separateness can be found. And so conventional truths or relative truth are the objects of our experience that we tend to misperceive and attach to them all kinds of meaning and expectations. So a big part of dukkha is that we expect way more out of pleasurable things than they can deliver, and think that we can attach to them and hold on to them, and that that will give us a sense of satisfaction or identity or value that we can count on, and so on. That things are born, come into existence, and then perish from existence, which is why death is so frightening, because the sense of having life, having me, and then losing me. When we talk about conditioning in Buddhism, in Western Buddhism, generally that term is often used as a synonym for socialization. To be conditioned, to study our conditioning is really what Marcus Borg, the author of this book, is writing about, is conventional wisdom, which is more a kind of psychological, sociological understanding of how we inculcate our culture and all of the messages that dominant culture consciousness teaches and holds close and sort of defines as reality and what culture is and what we're supposed to know. In Buddhism, conditioning has a very particular meaning, which is different. When the Buddha said that all conditioned existence is dukkha, the first noble truth, conditioned in Buddhism means dependently arisen. Conditioned means that something doesn't exist by itself, doesn't arise by itself, it's not autonomous, nothing exists in that way. The Buddha said nothing in the universe exists by itself autonomously, and that is therefore not subject to change, not subject to influence, is permanent. The Buddha said, if we look, we will not find a single thing, inside or outside, that has that characteristic. And so conditioned existence is the existence, the world of the relative truth, where everything exists in the way that our senses can perceive them. And because we perceive them, they seem to exist by themselves, right? So delusion is not like a big con game, like where we've all been duped. It's sort of an inevitable, a kind of automatic conclusion that we come to because we're in here and our senses look out and see things, right? I look out and see you, and you are not me, right? And so clearly you exist separate from me, apart from me, right? And therein the boundaries are drawn. And so, but to just recognize the sort of the caveats with what Borg is talking about, that because he speaks about this dominant consciousness as though it's a kind of singular thing, as though there is one culture, right? And so certainly in the West, in our country, there are many, many cultures. Ethnic cultures, racial cultures, regional cultures, class cultures, family cultures, religious cultures. In other words, any group, any community that shares something that binds that group together and that has a particular way of being in the world and therefore creates a certain worldview and ethos and behavior ethics and so on, as a way to define what it means to be in that group. I was thinking about when I, having grown up down south and when I first came up north and lived on a farm upstate New York, a dairy farm, the farmer, the main farmer that I worked with, Freeman Masker, he talked so fast. And so I kept saying, what? What? And he goes, are you stupid? I said, no, you just talk so fast. He said, I don't talk fast, I'm just talking. And then when I moved to New York City in my early 20s, you know, it's like I had grown up in a culture in which there were certain sort of acceptable modes of behavior. So I'd walk down the street, good morning, good morning. And there was a lot of yes, ma'am, yes, sir, yes, sir. And very quickly I realized, okay, somehow that's just not working. I'm not getting the expected response. I don't know quite what the rules are, but the old ones do not apply. And so, and of course, the dominant consciousness, as we know, is literally that, is usually the consciousness or the culture, the ethos, defined by the dominant group, right? So in our history of Western colonization, of patriarchy, of white supremacy, that is sort of the overarching dominant consciousness within a world of multiple cultures and ethnicities and groups and ways of seeing the world. But if we, just for the sake of our discussion, think of a kind of overarching consciousness which does, we are part of, we experience, because there is a dominant message, a dominant voice, a dominant dominant systems that all sort of support each other. And so the interesting thing I think about the way Borg talks about this, which is a little much more sort of fleshed out than in Buddhism, is in Buddhism the relative truth is really has to do, as I said before, with our perception, my experience of the world. And of course, implicit in that, and sometimes explicit in the teachings, is the role of family and culture and so on. But here, he's making it very explicit, sort of with our more contemporary Western understanding of how we are influenced and trained and taught by our respective cultures. You know, I was thinking about the Buddha, and that before he left home, or when we speak of him in his earlier life, it's usually, you know, as he spoke of himself, he was spoiled, he lived in a palace, he had all the good stuff. But I was thinking about the fact that he was part of the warrior caste. That was his role in the world, was to be a warrior. And so he was trained, that was part of his enculturated consciousness, was to battle, go to war. And so the tools of the spear and the bow and arrow and the sword and the knife and the hand-to-hand combat and the chariot, those were the skills that he was being trained in, and that he was no doubt seeing wars happening. They happened all throughout his life. And I just wondered, was that part of his wanting to leave home? Was he like one of the early conscientious objectors? Draft dodgers? Good for him. And so we are, so in terms of studying the self, right? Because again, even that, the way language tends to just narrow everything down to a very neat and tidy package. Oh, it's the self, right? So it's all here. I just turn in and there it is. Bingo. Study it, right? And then we begin to see that this self actually, while we perceive it as having boundaries, when we try and actually ascertain the thoughts, the emotions, the memories, the ethos, the worldview, it's like, how much of that is yours? How much of that did you come up with, right? Was your invention? I mean, it's ludicrous to even think of it that we can't, how can you even think of it, right? As though we grew up in a vacuum or a cage, or, which is of course not true. And so what is the enculturated consciousness, the self, that is, you know, a result of and acting out of our karma, and that has fixed ideas, views, that we are trying to illuminate, right view, and all of our habits of speech, which is so incredibly intricately bound up in our consciousness, and in the way everything, right? I mean, try to think of life without language. Try to think of being in the world without language. How can we even think of that, right? Because even if we think of, you can't just think of it in terms of not speaking, being silent, because it's our mind is constantly relating to the world through language. And so, right speech, right? And so right view isn't to have no view, right speech isn't to have no speech, because this is not practical or helpful in any way, but rather to see in which the ways our conditioned or socialized views and speech lead us inexorably to cause suffering and to create suffering and to suffer ourselves. And that if we try to parse that out, like what's mine and what's yours, what's mine and what's my family's, what's mine and what's my education, we can see sort of trails. Oh, I remember learning this, or I remember when so-and-so did that, and moments that were significant in terms of really bringing that message home. This is okay. This is absolutely not okay. You get a reward here, you get punished here. But those are just moments. Those are just isolated moments. And if we think of this education, if you will, happening nonstop, and all of the sources, right, which are basically unlimited, then we maybe can appreciate the project that we have undertaken. And that when we get frustrated, because like, why can't I just like get a handle on this? Why can't I just, you know, transform this pattern of behavior? Why can't I just not get caught in this habitual way of seeing or thinking or reacting? All of which I thought and admonished myself with gusto for many years in my early training, and got to a point where I realized, oh, I so underestimated this project. I so underestimated this project. I was so seeing this in very, very sort of one, maybe two-dimensional, right? It's just, you know, it's just like cleaning out a closet. Just, you know, just toss it out. It's clean. You know, what's all the fuss about? So, you know, when I began to understand that, it was much easier to be patient, a little bit easier to be patient, got easier, and to be less, you know, critical and sort of punitive with myself, as though this should not be happening, something else should be happening. I've been able to do this in other parts of my life. What's the problem? And so, as you said, it's the culture's social construction of reality and essentially the internalization. Because if it's not internalized, we haven't learned our lesson. Then that process has not been successful by society's standards. And so he goes on to say that conventional wisdom or relative truth provides guidance about how to live. And he talks about etiquette, you know, basic ways of behaving. And of course, this is where we can really see how, you know, within families, within regions, within communities and so on, how this can be very particular. It's not all the same. But within those respective groups, there are acceptable ways of behaving and acting and unacceptable ways. And, you know, the thing about this, you know, Sean yesterday talked about, you know, the relative truth is sacred, which is true because all things abide in their own Dharma state, as Stokin said. All things in and of themselves are complete. As Wendell Berry said, nothing is, everything is sacred, but we have desecrated, that is, made ugly or diminished or destroyed, tried to destroy what is sacred, right? By not recognizing what things really are. He says, but more importantly, relative truth embodies the central values of a culture, its understanding of what is worthwhile, and its images of the good life. And of course, this is where it really comes home. It's like, what is the recipe? What's the plan, right? So if as Buddhism believes that our impulse towards pleasure, or more broadly, what is affirming of life, and our impulse away from what is destructive or painful, destructive of life, is evidence of a basic sort of instinctual built-in inclination towards life. And of course, as human beings, we don't want just to live, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't mess with art and poetry. And I mean, who needs that stuff? You don't need that to live. Or do we? In other words, where there are certain things that we don't have that are beyond food and water and shelter, is that all we need to have a human life? And so to understand what is worthwhile and to be given the images of that, and of course that's part of our growing up, is learning what those things are. What are the things you're supposed to work towards that are going to give you X, Y, and Z? And depending on your personality, your circumstances, your strengths or weaknesses, your associations, mentors, seeming accidents of life, you know, you get to an intersection and you turn right rather than left. That can play out in a lot of different ways. But there is a basic theme. Having is good. Having more is better. Having it, you got to keep it. To keep it, you got to defend it. And then you got to constantly be aware of who's got more. And when that's not enough, get more. And then when that's not enough, maybe get something different. In other words, there's always an answer from within the same view. The answer is never, oh, this isn't working. Let's rethink this. That's not acceptable. I was reading an article just recently about a woman who grew up as a Jehovah's Witness. And she, it was very short, so there was very little detail, but she, at a certain point, decided to leave her, not just her religious community, but her whole life community, because it was her whole life. It was everyone she knew. And she had had an affair and had told her husband she wanted a divorce and was leaving the church. And so she had a meeting with some of the elders, who were all men, and she presented her case without apology. And they met privately and called her back in and said that because of this, and not only because she had an affair, which was, you know, she could find her way back from that if she worked hard enough, but she wanted to explore other faiths and try and really understand God. And for them, that was like the kiss of death. You cannot question. You cannot look beyond this to even suggest that that is something you want to do or need to do is sort of unpardonable. So she was shunned. That was the response. So she knew that was going to happen. So she completely was cut off from everyone that she had known her whole life. And how that lines up, I've never quite understood how that lines up with, you know, the teachings of Jesus and, like, you know, sort of the basic message of Christianity, which is really a lot of what this book is about, is how within, because it's not just a dominant consciousness within a society, but it's within religions. And so what is worthwhile? What is the good life? And so when we think about the Buddhist path, about raising bodhicitta, the Buddha had all of that. Right? He was immersed and had been given the good life. And he had the audacity to declare that this was not only was it not enough, it was not the good life. And so in a way, there was no other alternative but for him to leave. Because to stay within was to have to continue to work within the whole of that mind state to be accepted. And so that element of leaving home, you know, and of course we do that in a generally less drastic way, but often I don't know what it's like now. You know, if you come into practice, some of you know, because it's, you know, Buddhism is in a very different place than it was years ago. It's more familiar, it's more common, it's, you know, not such a big deal. You know, when I first started getting involved in Buddhism, I didn't talk about it to anybody. Nobody knew I was interested in Buddhism. Not my parents, nobody. I didn't even think about talking about it with anybody. It was not something anybody else was talking about or thinking about or seemed to know about. Being in Georgia, I thought I might get thrown in jail. So he says, because of this, it's this conventional wisdom, which is really, again, sort of beyond the basic Buddhist teaching of relative truth. It's much more sort of the broader implications of not just how we perceive things, but how we create a world and the self and other selves. Because what we do to ourselves, we not only do to other people, we do to every living thing. Endow it with absolute qualities and characteristics, which means that thing, the grass, is green. That's what it is. And that my eyes that see the green, I'm just an objective witness. I don't have anything to do with its greenness. Green exists intrinsically, existentially within the grass. Grass is one thing, but when we look at another person and we immediately have a response. I like them, I don't like them. I could trust this person, I can't trust them. I feel safe, I don't feel safe. Then it has much more profound implications. And the fact that I don't see my mind creating, projecting, I just think I'm having an objective experience, that those experience, what I'm experiencing exists in the person. From that view, a lot of what happens makes sense. Doesn't mean it's good, but it makes sense. It has a logic to it. And that's why questioning, examining, disrupting the conventional wisdom that he speaks about is problematic within a society. It can be problematic within a family. It can be problematic within the faith of one's birth, or it can be problematic within a world that has already been well established and in which there are norms and that we are expected to know what to do. You know, when I was leaving high school, I graduated a semester early. I was eager to leave, to get out. And so I just left. I remember it was my last day of class. There was another semester. And I just walked out the door. I just walked out. I didn't go to my graduation. I was like, I'm done. I'm finished. And when I looked around, I'm like, okay, big shot. Now what? Right? And I looked at my friends, you know, and they're like, well, they're either going to college or they're just going to get a job. And I'm like, that's it? The world is vast and wide, and those are the choices. And I was going to have to support myself. I mean, at that point, staying at home after high school was not something that was done, right? So I was leaving, and I knew I was going to have to support myself, but it was like, but the mentality of those two, just because those two are things that people do and you can do, and it's almost like forestalling, putting off the place where I felt like I was at that moment. And I thought, what if I don't do either of those things? I don't just go get any job and I don't go to school. Something else will happen. I will have to do something else. But in that, when we don't go the way that we have, in a sense, been taught to go, and whether that's really just spiritually, internally, it's our way of thinking about things, seeing things, or whether it's a more decisive or, you know, sort of recognizable change of life. Oftentimes what comes along with that is solitude, aloneness. You might be alone in this, at least for a while. And that's part, I think, of the courage that being a practitioner requires, is to not know what's up ahead. No guarantees, no promises. But that to just stay the course, or just to do what we're supposed to do, is either just not satisfying, you know that already, or it's not even possible. It is not possible for you to do that. Because it's just not how you seem to be built. And I remember there were times where I thought, it would be so much easier if I could just, like, you know, do what my friends are doing, or just shut up, like, and like, do something simple, do something safe, do something, right, that sort of has a plan. But that wasn't going to work out. So he says this conventional wisdom is often based on the dynamic, the system of rewards and punishments, right? If you do the right thing, you will get rewarded. And if you don't do the right thing, well, and that the corollary, he says, is that if you're doing well, it's because you did the right thing. And if you're not doing well, it's because you screwed up, right? You didn't get the message. You didn't learn the lesson, right? So it's internalized. There's something wrong with me, or there's something right with me. And he goes on to say that becomes sort of our sense of self, our identity, our self-esteem. We internalize our sense of self based on how we're doing, where the standard has been set by this enculturated consciousness. And from a Buddhist, he talks a lot about, you know, Jesus's mission to subvert. And the Buddha wasn't really like that. It's kind of interesting. You know, he taught very clearly about caste and said it's illusory, it's a false notion. There is no difference. He was very clear about the Buddha nature, the potential for women to realize themselves, and they did. He was very clear about that. But he wasn't trying to dismantle that dominant consciousness. He wasn't trying to dismantle the systems that existed at his time. The revolution that he had undergone and was teaching was this inner revolution. Now, of course, that causes disruption in lives, hopefully good disruption. And that, you know, as practitioners, it's not always perceived as good by others. It doesn't always feel good. But the Buddhist practice should not be causing divides. It should not actually be causing more suffering. Sometimes there is necessary pain that is required to chart a new path. Pain within oneself, pain upon others, because they had other expectations for you. Because people who love us, you know, generally want us to be good and happy and safe. And so we tend to think, well, you do what I did, right? Because that, I know that. And if you do what I did, then I can kind of settle down and don't have to worry so much. If you do something completely off the grid, I don't know what to do with that. Right? I can't, it's hard for me to feel trusting and safe with that because I've not done that. And so that's where the solitary part comes in, the aloneness part. I remember when I moved in 1986 and I knew I wanted to be a monk. I had a conversation with Dada Roshi before I moved in. I sat down with him in Kyoto down in what is the common room now. It was the office back then. And we were sitting there, and I'm like, oh, I'm so nervous. And I sat down. It was after lunch on a Sunday, and I said, they already knew I was coming to residency. I said, I want to be a monk. And Dido looked at me, and he took me seriously, and we had a conversation. And I looked at Kyoto, and she said, that's nice. And I thought, she doesn't believe me. She doesn't believe me. And that was good, actually. That was good. What was the point of that? I don't remember what the point of that was. Maybe it'll come back. I am who I am according to the standards of conventional wisdom, and I will think well or poorly of myself depending on how well I measure up to its standards. Conventional wisdom is this life under the superego, he says, that which stands over me, the internalized voice of culture. the storehouse of oughts within our head. It functions as a generally critical internalized voice, the internal cop and judge. And of course, you know, it really does seem that our culture, our society, has consciously and to some degree unconsciously perhaps created a highly developed system for internalizing distrust and self-doubt. It's pretty epidemic, and it's not new. It's been going on quite a while. But the degree to which that is internalized within us, and you know, if you just think about what are the images that you see? Beautiful people having beautiful lives in beautiful bodies, you know, they're not fucked up. Right? You're not like messing with all this shit that you're messing with. Right? They're perfect. Smooth skin. Right? All of it. They're happy. They're so happy. Right? So what's wrong with you? And that even the rebels, you know, what's interesting is within this whole system, even the rebels have to get appropriated and brought into that culture. So they become just another part of that dominant culture, which is sort of what gives us that sense of, yeah, I'm on my own, you know. I haven't drunk the Kool-Aid. But the interesting, the important thing about this, I lost my train, about Buddhism is that the Buddha wasn't trying to overturn. His is a path of peace. And that doesn't mean just going along. He didn't. He didn't just go along. He caused some trouble. He did some things that had not been done. But he understood that the path of alleviating suffering has to, in every step, be not creating suffering. And so how, when we, in our time, in our Sangha, are trying actually to disrupt systems that not only oppress people and do, but also oppress everybody, right? The oppressor becomes part of the system that is experiencing suffering, creating suffering. I remember all the years I was going into prison, and every time I went in, I would look at the guards and everybody who worked in it, and I thought, you're in prison. Yeah, you get to go home, but this is where your life is. And this is what your life is about. And there are good people doing good things. That's not to diminish some of the real bodhisattva work that happens in prisons on both sides of the bars. But that in that environment, it's like, what's that like? How does that change a person's consciousness? And so how do we disrupt the systems internally and externally that are causing the suffering, that are inculcating that consciousness that binds us to the false views, to the attachments, to the fears and insecurities, to the anchors, that perpetuates the violence that is unnecessary, wholly caused by our minds? How do we do that without creating more of the same? That is the great challenge. Because it's easy to, it appears easy to stop the fighting by fighting, right? That's been going on a long time. To attack the hate with hatred. But that is not this path. And that requires a whole large measure of inquiry and examination and skill and development of those skills and everything that we call Buddha Dharma. He says, whether in religious or secular form, conventional wisdom creates a world in which we live. It constructs a world. Indeed, it is the construction. It's a domestication of reality, a net we cast over reality. It's basically life within the socially constructed world. And life in this world can be and often is grim. A life of bondage to that culture, living by what he calls the performance principle. Everything we do is measured by how we perform. And he said, ultimately, it's a life of profound self-preoccupation. Where am I? How am I? How am I doing? How am I measuring up? You know, it's sort of like being a great chef or a great artist or a great anything, and you produce something and people love it and they love you, and now what do you do? What's your next act? The way we see ourselves and the way we experience ourselves is dependent on that, it's kind of like a tyranny. There is no rest. There is no ease. There's, you know, the night of applause and good reviews. That's nice, right? But then there's the next performance. You got to start planning for that right away. And how are you possibly going to top the last one? And so what the Buddha realized and offered is there's a way. And it's not through destruction. As John Lewis talked about, good trouble, right? The deepest level of trouble that really needs to be brought about. Because it's just like delusion. When we don't do anything, our karma and everything that has already been put into place just keeps humming along. It has no reason to do otherwise. In fact, it has every reason to do the same, because that's where all the momentum is. That's where all the everything is. Except in that moment where from that deep sleep you open one eye and think, hold on, I'm not buying this. Not in this life. Not for this person. There has to be another way. And sometimes when we just don't go down that well-known path and don't go down with that well-known path, you find a new path. And that's what happens a whole heap of the time on this cushion, is having the courage to go a different way. And when you do, it will feel weird and strange, and Mara will come up and say, hold on, who do you think you are? Get back in place. In one of the sutras, the Buddha says, do you think that when you start shaking the rafters of the house, Mara is just going to sit by and watch? Hell no. She's going to raise some hell towards you. And does she know exactly how to get into your most soft belly? Sneak up on you. So we don't see her coming. We don't see him coming. It's just like, whoa, yeah, I am a piece of shit. I am never going to do this. I am not doing this. People come in and say, I can't do this. I say, I think you are. This is what doing it looks like. What is it that you're not doing? What is it that you can't do? One thing, all things move among them and intermingle without distinction. To realize that's what is so profound about this teaching of the two truths of dependent origination, of Prajnaparamita. That's why they are spoken of as jewels. Because it's not about extinguishing or destroying or cutting anything off or denying. That's the script. That is the well-worn path. We might be applying it to new targets, new objects, but it's the same path. Move among them and intermingle without distinction. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this faith is a road to non-duality, because the non-dual, Prajnaparamita, Buddha nature, is one with the trusting mind. Buddha nature is what makes compassion possible. It's what makes practice possible. It's what makes faith possible. And so that's why in studying the self, you know, in traditional Buddhism, the teachings are, if you're going to read, there's a passage in Sweet Monkey where Dogen kind of goes about talking about you shouldn't spend your time reading poetry and, literature and stuff, because you just read the Dharma. And at the end he says, But I do actually read. But the oftentimes teachers will say what they talk about reading beyond Dharma is reading like natural sciences, the thing, other fields that are basically examining the world, examining what is real. And that's why I find this so helpful, because he's not Buddhist, but he's speaking in a language that we can completely understand. He's talking about a world that is the world that we're examining, and in much of the same language. Now, of course, where he goes with that, right, because he's a Christian and he's talking about this from within the context of that, is down that path, that honorable path. But the recognition is the same. Isn't that interesting? And so if we want to bring forth a clear mind, it means we practice a clear mind. If we want to bring forth compassion, it means we actually have to be practicing compassion. When Thich Nhat Hanh said peace is every step, he wasn't kidding. He wasn't being metaphorical. He was like, no, that's actually how it works. That's how it's done. That's how we do it. And that appears in a whole multitude of forms. Sometimes it appears in a moment of calmness. Sometimes it appears in a moment of anger. Sometimes it appears in a moment of unity. Sometimes it appears in a moment of divisiveness. Nothing is left out. There's no moment that we cannot take refuge in the Dharma, that we cannot practice. It's not always clear how. That's fair. That's how we learn. How fortunate we are.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.